Chapter 5. Ryder had lost track of time. He was pretty sure they were still in the trunk of a car, but he sensed that they had stopped. He must have fallen asleep. He heard a click, followed by a creaking sound, and then cool air rushed in over him.
"Are they dead?" a man's voice said. "In the name of God and country, please tell me we didn't kill the little bastards."
"I'm alive!"
Jeff shouted. There was some shuffling.
"Good for you," a second voice said. "What about your brother?"
Ryder considered playing possum just to see what would happen, but that would scare Jeff and maybe piss the cops off.
"I'm here," he said.
"So you are. Welcome to your new home."
Ryder heard some more movement, and Jeff squeaked. Maybe it was pain, maybe something else. Before he had a chance to think too much about it, a strong hand clenched around the top of his right arm and pulled him to a sitting position. 2 seconds later, a fist grabbed his T-shirt. An arm wrapped around his hips, and he was airborne, with something hard pressed into his gut. In his mind, the guy had him in a fireman's carry. The man carrying him had a bounce in his step that made the hood pull away from Ryder's face a little. He blew onto it as if to put out a birthday candle, and that pushed the fabric away a little more. If he craned his neck and looked down and to the right, he could see movement. The legs of the guy who was carrying him appeared and disappeared from his field of view. It was still nighttime, so what he saw were more suggestions of legs than actual ones. He couldn't tell what the guy was walking on. Grass, maybe? He couldn't smell any grass, but he wasn't sure that he'd be able to smell anything past the shield of burlap stink anyway. When they transitioned to gravel, the bouncing on Ryder's middle eased. He heard talking from somewhere, and he thought he recognized Jeff's voice, but he couldn't be sure. Knowing his little brother, he was probably asking where they were going. Stupid question when you consider that they're going to be there soon anyway. And if he recalled correctly, the last time Jeff asked questions, he'd gotten them both brained. Finally, there was a bit of light, just enough to reveal that the gravel he suspected was, in fact, real, and that the man was wearing black boots. The gravel changed to some kind of white stone, and then there were steps, made of wood, he thought, but he couldn't be sure. Brighter light. Much brighter light. They'd arrived at a real place. This was the place where the men who pretended to be cops, real cops didn't dump people into the trunks of cars, would do to them whatever it was they wanted to do. Ryder felt the sour bubble of panic beginning to rise again in his gut.
"Hey, Jeff," he said, "are you there? What's happening?"
Before Ryder could answer, the angle changed, and he felt for a second that he was being flung somewhere. Turned out he was, and when he landed on his left side, he was surprised there was no pain. Well, his wrists hurt a little more, but he'd pretty much gotten used to that. The man carrying him had plopped him onto what felt like a bed.
"All right, boys," one of the men said.
Ryder's hood was yanked off, and he squinted against light that wasn't as bright as he'd anticipated. He smelled wood smoke and candle wax. When he looked over to his brother, he had to stifle a laugh. Jeff's hair was standing straight out from his head.
"My name is Officer Al, and that is Officer Kim. We'll be taking care of you while you're here."
Both men were dark-skinned, but not black, and they looked strong. Officer Kim had a Bruce Lee vibe to him. He was the one with the red mark on his face, the one who had hit Ryder. Both wore police uniforms.
If you promise to behave, we'll free your wrists and feet, Officer Rao continued. Officer Kim added, But if you give us any shit, you'll be back in cuffs, and that will be just the beginning of your punishment. Do you understand? Jeff started to cry.
Does that make you feel big?
Ryder asked.
Making kids cry?
Officer Kim pointed a threatening finger at him.
Watch your mouth, he said.
He drew a stick out of his gun belt and shook it hard to make it extend out 2 feet. Ryder's stomach flipped.
Give them a break, Officer Al said.
He's got a point. Why be such a hard ass?
Because I want them to know that I wouldn't even blink before killing them.
Look at me, boys, Officer Al said. You're not going to be troublemakers, are you? Jeff shook his head enthusiastically, but Ryder didn't want to give him the satisfaction. His head shake was subtle.
That one's going to be trouble, Officer Kim said. Maybe we should kill him now and be done with it.
Ryder felt himself tremble, but he hoped it didn't show. The logical side of his mind told him that if killing them were an option, they'd be dead now. Mom and Dad had sort of talked about that.
There are a lot of bad people out there, Dad had said. They'll treat you like shit just to make you bend to their will. To keep your self-respect, hold out till it hurts too much. Then, when you give in, be proud of your resistance, not ashamed of your compliance.
Ryder remembered being confused at the time, but now he got it. It didn't hurt enough yet.
Which one are you? Officer Al asked. Ryan or Jeff?
I'm Ryder.
Officer Al scowled.
You shitting me?
No, that's really his name,
Jeff said.
His tone projected an urgent edge. Officer Al shrugged.
All right then, Ryder it is. You're not going to be a pain in the ass, are you? Because I can tell you we are not the people to mess with. I know I sound like the good cop and Officer Kim sounds like the bad cop, but believe me when I tell you, we both have bad sides that you don't want to see.
He produced a tiny key from a pouch on his belt. Lean forward, and I'll get those cuffs off your wrists. That answered one question. Ryder had suspected that his hands had been tied with handcuffs, but he couldn't be sure. Now that he was paying attention, he saw that his ankles had been cuffed, too. He didn't even know that ankle cuffs were a thing. 30 seconds later, his arms and legs were his again.
Go ahead and stand, Officer Al said. Work some of the stiffness out.
As he slid his butt off the bed and set his feet on the floor, Ryder looked over to his brother, who seemed to be moving too gently.
You okay?
Jeff rubbed his wrists and sidestepped over to Ryder, who put his arm around him. Outside of a few formal family portraits, this was the only time he'd done that.
We'll be fine, Ryder said.
He rubbed Jeff's shoulder the way Dad would do when he was comforting them. They were in an old house, a log cabin, maybe? The walls were mostly covered in sheetrock, but the huge fireplace in the middle of the long wall was surrounded by horizontal stripes of wood and mortar. It was hard to tell if it looked like that on purpose or if the place was falling apart.
This is your new home, Officer Al explained.
Are we under arrest? Ryder asked.
They didn't have to know that he knew they weren't cops.
Yes.
But this isn't a jail.
Do you want to be in jail? Officer Kim asked. There are a lot of bad hombres in jail.
Are you gonna hurt us?
Jeff asked. Ryder was grateful that his brother had asked it.
Not if you don't make us, Officer Al said.
Do what you're told and everything will be fine.
Ryder took in the surroundings. The inside of the cabin was shaped like an L. The king-sized bed they'd been dropped onto sat across from the roaring fireplace at the corner where the long leg of the L met the short leg. The bed was on the short part. The only light in the room came from the fireplace and from a few table lamps, including one on the nightstand next to the bed. He looked behind him, down the long side of the L, and he saw a shelf filled with books on the left. Beyond the shelves, at the very end, sat a water cooler, the kind you'd find in an office, with a big bottle of water sitting on top of it. The right-hand side of the long wall was taken up by another bookshelf, and then there was an area blocked off by a cloth screen he couldn't see through. In between, the empty space in front of the door was filled with what looked like a homemade dining table surrounded by two backless wooden benches.
"Tell them about the shoes and socks," Officer Kim said. He hadn't moved from his spot on the far side of the bed, and his expression hadn't softened.
Officer Al seemed uneasy.
"Okay, this is going to sound weird, but I need you to take off your shoes and socks."
Ryder's gut clenched.
"Why?"
"Please just do as I ask." "Is that all you're going to make us take off?"
Officer Al laughed.
"Relax, kid. You're not my type. This is not that kind of party."
Jeff looked to Ryder for confirmation. Ryder answered by sitting back on the edge of the bed and kicking off his Reeboks.
"Why are we doing this?"
"All in good time," Officer Al said. "Thank you for cooperating."
Ryder and Jeff pulled their socks off next.
"Now what?"
The cop held out his hands.
"Give them to me."
The boys did as they were told. Once Officer Al had their stuff, Officer Kim crossed behind his partner to take them away and throw them in the fireplace. Ryder leapt from the mattress.
"Hey!"
Officer Al pushed him back with a shove on the chest.
"You wanted to know. Now I'll tell you. When you're barefoot, you'll be less apt to run away."
That's when it hit Ryder that they truly were prisoners. Tears pressed behind his eyes, and he knew they were turning red. He clenched his teeth and breathed heavily through his nose to will the emotion away.
"And if you try to run away, we'll shoot you,"
Officer Kim said, walking away from the hearth to join his partner. Jeff pressed closer to Ryder, grabbed his hand. Ryder almost pulled away. Holding hands was a baby thing to do, but tonight it was okay.
"Let me give you the big picture," Officer Al continued. "We are in the middle of nowhere, miles from the next anything. Gets colder up here this time of year than you're used to in Virginia, but it's not so bad. 50s at night, 70s during the day. Got extra blankets over there in the drawers under the bookcases. Basically, this house is yours. There's no running water, but there's a compost toilet over there behind the screen and plenty of water in the jug. You'll find glasses and toilet paper and whatever else you need in the drawers."
"Why are you doing this?" Ryder asked.
"Can't answer that," Officer Al said. "Kim and I are here to keep you safe and fed."
"And to shoot us,"
Jeff said softly.
"And to shoot you,"
Officer Al acknowledged.
"But that's only as a last resort. Follow the rules, and you won't have to worry about that, or any of the other terrible punishments we can come up with."
Ryder felt a chill. Officer Al's eyes stayed totally friendly as he said that.
"Want to spend a week or so with your hands and feet in those cuffs? We can do that. We can break your legs or gouge out your eyes, but shooting is only a last resort."
Ryder couldn't stop the tears this time.
But why?
Officer Al rumpled Ryder's hair, but the boy pulled away.
I don't want to scare you more than I have to, little man. I just need you to know that serious infractions bring serious results. We'll lock the door at night, but unlock it during the day. You can't see it now, but there's a fence around this place. You're welcome to walk around outside, but you should stay away from the fence. First of all, the razor wire will cut you down to the blue meat, and there are sensors on the fence that'll tell us if someone is trying to climb it. That's when we'd have to shoot you.
Where will you be?
We'll be around, Officer Kim said. We'll bring you food, Officer Al said. You'll have plenty of water.
He lowered his voice. And if you don't mind me saying, you should use some of that water to wash your pants. You guys stink.
Ryder felt his face flush. There's soap and towels over there, too, and a dry sink. You'll figure it out.
Officer Al looked at his partner, then back at his prisoners.
That's about it. Breakfast comes when it comes, normally around 7:30. If you have any questions, save them till then.
Night, boys.
The boys did nothing but stare as the two cops headed out the door and into the night. A few seconds later, something metal slid into something solid, and they were alone.
Oh my God, Rye! What's happening?
Ryder settled himself with a huge breath and then started working on the button on his jeans.
Officer Asshole is right about one thing. We stink.
He padded back to the corner with the water jug and wondered how to wash the stink out. If Connie Kendall kept her fingers laced behind her head as she lay flat on her back on her bunk, and if she kept her legs flexed just enough for her feet to rest flat against the thin mattress, she could ease the pain that shot down her left arm from the pinched nerve in her cervical spine. Under normal circumstances, strict adherence to a stretching regimen could keep the pain under control, but after the aggressiveness of her arresting agents, the kinked muscles in her shoulder had turned to rock, and her left arm felt like it was on fire. For good or ill, she was the sole occupant of her concrete holding cell. She figured the dimensions to be roughly 8 by 10 feet. She knew for a fact that the cell was precisely 10 toe-to-heels from front wall to back wall, but 1.5 feet shorter, measuring side to side. The small space was a monument to efficiency, providing enough space for 2 stacked cots, a combo toilet and sink, and a tilt-down plank that doubled as a dining table or desk, equally accessible from the toilet or the edge of the bed. It reminded her a little of the efficiency apartment she and Craig had rented in Paris before the boys came along. The jail cell had the edge on seating comfort, but it couldn't touch the view.
Oh, Craig, why did you have to get yourself killed?
Ah, the view. A solid steel wall defined the view of what would anywhere else be her front yard. With the hinges on the outside, the door from her perspective was a black rectangle that could have been drawn with a Sharpie. Another rectangle in the middle of the larger one marked the location of her food slot, the only element of the door that had opened since the whole thing closed on her 3 days ago. At least, she thought it was 3 days. Without a view to the outside, and without access to a light switch, she was at the mercy of her captors when it came to her perception of time. She noted with casual interest that the 2 corners where 2 walls met the ceiling showed nearly identical triangles of spalling. In both spots, rusted blobs of rebar emerged from the slate-colored concrete like tumors from weathered skin. Connie had every reason to believe that her attorney, Rafael Iglesias, would disperse whatever fertilizer needed to be spread
to get her out of here on bail, but at moments like this, when so much time had passed without seeing a soul, the demons were knocking at the door of her mind. The government was playing its usual games. Her isolation was part of the same rulebook that made them refuse to tell her anything about her boys. Infliction of psychological stress. As if the work she'd been doing with Craig for the past 3 years hadn't immunized her against stresses that were far more life-altering than a few days in a locked room. Connie was terrified that decades in a locked room lay ahead for her, but that was where Raphael came in. He and his bosses owned every politician who mattered, and every prosecutor, too, as if there were a difference. She told herself that the mere fact that she had been denied access to counsel for this much time was a building block in her ultimate defense. The lock on her door turned, startling her. It was too soon for another meal. Maybe they'd finally found Raphael, or more likely, Raphael had found her. When the door opened, she saw three guards in SWAT gear surrounding the opening. One held a big shield, while the other two held what appeared to be the kind of pepper spray canisters you could buy for use against grizzlies when you visited Yellowstone. Connie swung her feet to the floor and prepared for the worst. A guard stepped out from behind the assault team. This guy wore a white shirt and green pants and sported the kind of beard that was either stylish or reflected the fact that he forgot to shave this morning. "Okay, Kendall," he said. "This is your moment to whine to your mouthpiece." Connie stood from her cot. "It's Mrs. Kendall," she said. "Actually, it's 40343, the guard corrected, invoking Connie's prison number. I was being polite.
"Fair enough. So, do I refer to you as Screw, as they do in the movies?"
The guard took a menacing step forward. "Don't ever assume parity with us," he said. "You refer to me as Lieutenant Hoffman, and my officers as Officer. You are the property of the United States government, and we are the citizens charged with maintaining the zoo. This is our first meeting, but trust me when I say that you do not want to try me on this point." Connie saw Hoffman as predatory, a man not to be crossed. She'd seen the same fierceness in the eyes of the cartel leaders she'd dealt with. They emitted a disregard for humanity. Connie didn't doubt that the man in the white shirt, and perhaps his padded colleagues, considered her to occupy the same level on the evolutionary scale as a cockroach.
"Lieutenant Hoffman, it shall be," Connie said.
She knew what came next. She turned her back to the crew at her door, took 2 steps closer, and presented her hands behind her back for the cuffing and shackling that she'd been told upon arrival would be the norm for any movement outside of her block. They did the wrists first, and then the leg irons. The guards moved with a practiced efficiency that had her thoroughly trussed in under a minute. When they were done, the swatted-out guards stepped back, and Lieutenant Hoffman took charge. "Walk at my pace," Hoffman said as he wrapped his hand around Connie's left biceps. "I won't push you faster than the shackles can handle." His tone seemed surprisingly kind. Gentle pressure on her arm urged her forward, and she complied. In the blur that was the night of her arrest, the details of her place of confinement had apparently eluded her because much of the surroundings looked strange to her. She now saw that her cell was little more than a hole that had been carved into a concrete canyon. Hers was at the end of a hallway that appeared that it might at one time have been a tunnel into a mine. Mesh-covered fluorescent light tubes bathed the entire length of the place with orange light. Connie's sense of dread began to blossom. everything in this place was either steel or concrete. Until they lift your isolation order, you'll be on lockdown 23 hours a day, Hoffman explained, as if listening to Connie's thoughts. Otherwise, in this block, it's 22 hours of lockdown. That explained why all the other doors were closed.
Not a big believer in sunlight?
Connie asked. I didn't design the place, Hoffman said. I just enforced the rules, and in case it wasn't expressed to you strongly enough, I enforced those rules strictly. The SWAT force escorted them to the end of the cell block, as far as a wall of steel bars. The wall slid open as they approached. At Hoffman's urging, Connie shuffled through the opening and forward about 8 feet until she was facing another wall of bars. After Hoffman slipped in behind her, the first bars closed again and the second wall opened.
We call this a man trap, Hoffman said, and it's exactly what it sounds like.
Connie had seen similar setups in airports and certain banks, but not designed to this level of security. A second man trap followed, and then a steel door led to a 12-by-12 room with a line of 4 stools that might have been stolen from a dining hall, lining a thick plexiglass wall that featured a long beige formica table, sprouting vertical dividers between the stools. Well-worn, old-school yellow-wired telephones hung at each divided station. Connie and Hoffman were the only 2 people on this side of the plexiglass, but a corporate-looking lawyer sat on the other side, waiting for his client.
I thought you told me my lawyer was here, Connie said.
And there he is, Hoffman pointed to the man on the other side.
That's not my lawyer.
I don't pick the lawyers either, Hoffman said. I just
enforce the rules. Yeah, I get it, but he's still not my lawyer.
Hoffman peered around Connie to look again at the man in the suit.
He looks like a lawyer to me. And he says he's your lawyer.
Connie started to object.
But, Hoffman continued, I can't make you sit down and talk to anyone you don't want to. If you'd prefer the view inside your cell, I can take you back to lockdown. Your call.
Connie saw the smirk and realized how foolish she must seem. Any view other than poured concrete was a welcome relief.
Can I lose the chains while I'm in here?
Afraid not. Well, I can give you a free hand, but the leg irons have to stay. They're awkward till you get used to them, but after a few weeks, some say they feel awkward without them.
Hoffman pointed toward the glass bubbles recessed into the drop ceiling.
We'll be watching, but we can't hear. You've got 30 minutes, or until your lawyer leaves, or whoever the hell he is. So are you staying?
Connie answered by pivoting and shuffling toward the man behind the glass. When she stopped at the table, Hoffman undid the bracelet on her right wrist, then slipped it through a reinforced loop that was bolted to the table. The suit watched, but his face remained blank. The expression reminded Connie of some of the surgeons she'd met over the years through Craig, men so impressed with their own magnificence that personality seemed unnecessary. Since the stool was supported by a buttress in the wall, Connie could shift her shackled ankles under the seat and straddle it like a saddle. The suit lifted a telephone handset from his side of the glass, brought it to his face, and waited while Connie settled in. Connie used her free hand to lift her handset, and as she did, she wondered how many unspeakable viruses resided on the mouthpiece.
Where's Raphael?
My name is James Abrenio, the suit said. I'm your lawyer. If it weren't for the 5 o'clock shadow, he'd have looked like a child. Soft features and bright eyes with an engaging smile, impeccably dressed in a tailored blue suit with a starched white shirt and a perfectly Windsor-knotted red tie, he'd clearly seen success.
Like hell you are. Rafael Iglesias is my lawyer.
Abrenio shook his head. The court has appointed me to serve as your lawyer.
They can't do that.
Abrenio's smile disappeared. Facts and evidence indicate that they can. I know I'm not your first choice in legal representation, but I'm very good at what I do.
So is Rafael Iglesias.
Connie heard the frustration rising in her voice, and she tamped it down.
This conversation has become circular. You're fired.
Abrenio seemed to have been expecting that. You are certainly within your right to do that, he said. And when you do, the U.S. attorney will appoint another. And then another, if you'd like. At no point, however, will you speak to Rafael Iglesias, Armand Cortez, or any other member of the C-squared set. Connie recognized C-squared as the media's flippant shortcut for the Cortez cartel.
You've been working with murderers, Mrs. Kendall, and the government has built a strong case that you are also a murderer.
Connie's heart rate picked up as she felt her face flush. She'd been keeping it together in the knowledge that she would be sprung as soon as the Cortez machinery shifted into gear.
You sound more like a prosecutor than a defense attorney, Connie said.
Abrenio lightened his posture and folded his arms across his chest, but not before he ensured that his lapels would not bunch.
You couldn't be more wrong. I'm a very good defense attorney. And one of the rules of a very good defense attorney is to make sure his client understands what the stakes are. Uncle Sam has picked you for a very special shit list. Your arraignment is tomorrow morning, and you'll be attending via video chat. You're going to plead not guilty, and then you and I are going to build a case.
The door on Connie's side of the window, the door she'd just passed through, opened. And there was Lieutenant Hoffman again. This time he had a well-primped woman with him. She was tall and attractive, and her face showed nothing but malice.
"This meeting is over," the woman said. "Who are you?"
Connie asked. She looked back through the glass, and Abrenio looked concerned. She asked him who the newcomer was, then she realized he couldn't hear her, brought the phone back to her face, and asked again. Abrenio exclaimed, "That's Sandra Grosvenor, the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia."
"I said this meeting is over," Grosvenor repeated. "Take that phone receiver from her hand."
Hoffman looked a little apologetic as he walked forward. Connie put the handset down before he could take it from her. As Hoffman released Connie's left hand from the loop in the table, he grasped her biceps to help her stand, then refastened the cuffs behind her back. Connie looked toward Abrenio. Someone had entered his side of the glass as well, another suit, and the conversation they were having did not look pleasant.
"I don't understand," Connie said. "What is going on?"
Hoffman said nothing. She turned her attention to Grosvenor.
"What are you doing to me?"
The prosecutor said nothing. Instead, she jerked her head in a silent, "Follow me." Hoffman guided Connie out of that interview room, through another man-trap, and then into a different, slightly more elegant version of the previous interview room. This time she got to sit in a metal-backed chair that was bolted to the floor, and there were no heavy partitions or telephone handsets to speak into. It wasn't anything close to comfortable, but it was a hell of a lot better than the round stools from the first interview room.
"Lieutenant Hoffman," she said, "can you tell me what's going on here?"
"I'll be honest with you," he replied. "The short answer is no. Even if I knew, I couldn't tell you. But in this case, I genuinely have no idea. You must be one hell of an important lady, ma'am, because we are turning ourselves inside out to accommodate you."
What kind of accommodations?
Hoffman cocked his head and gave her what might have been an attempt at a warm smile.
Just hang tight. Soon enough you'll know everything you're allowed to know.
And then she was alone. Hoffman's parting words haunted her.
Did they really understand the magnitude of the things she'd done?
The door opened again, and this time Grosvenor and Abrenio entered together. That couldn't possibly be anything but a bad sign, could it? Abrenio took a chair next to Connie, while the woman stood by the chair opposite her, on the other side of the table.
If you haven't already figured it out, I am Sandra Grosvenor, United States Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia.
She hadn't yet sat. In fact, she hadn't made eye contact.
You're looking at life in prison, if you're lucky, she continued. A needle if you're unlucky. We have you for the murder of Pavel Grigonovich, and we're this close to linking you with at least two others.
She presented her thumb and forefinger only an eighth of an inch apart.
I want my lawyer, Connie said.
It was the only thing she could think of. She herself was a corporate attorney, for crying out loud, not a defense attorney. In a situation like this, she was as reliant on cop show tropes as any other citizen.
You have your lawyer, Grosvenor said.
I'll try not to be offended, Abrenio said.
No, I have the lawyer you chose for me, Connie insisted.
The point is, you have a lawyer, Grosvenor said.
You have representation.
I don't want him as my lawyer. I have a lawyer.
Grosvenor turned her attention to Abrenio.
For the record, Counselor, are you taking Mrs. Kendall on as a client?
I am. You are not!
Abrenio leaned closer to Connie and touched her arm. She shook him off, and he retracted his hand as if hit with electricity.
I meant no harm, he said.
I think we need to talk privately. You can fire me afterward if you'd like.
He shifted his attention to Grosvenor, who was already rising from her seat.
I'll leave you two to speak. Arraignment's at 9 sharp tomorrow. I'll see you both then.
Grosvenor leaned in close to Connie and drilled her with a hard look.
Get your head out of your ass, Mrs. Kendall. You know what you have done, and we know what you have done. It's rare under circumstances like these to receive second chances. Listen very carefully to what Mr. Abrenio has to say.
Connie and Abrenio sat in silence while Grosvenor made her way to the door and rapped on it. It opened and closed, and they were alone.
Have you already spoken to her about my case? Connie asked.
Of course, he replied, at least through tomorrow's arraignment. I'm your lawyer whether you like it or not. As such, it's a good idea to know I have nothing to say to you, Connie said.
Sometimes it was best to get ahead of what you knew was coming.
That's perfect, Abrenio said. That means you won't interrupt when I explain what's going on. Cutting to the chase, Uncle Sam doesn't care about you. They want your boss.
Connie kept her features flat. Abrenio already knew everything about her, or else he wouldn't have been hand-picked by the government to pretend to be her lawyer. She refused to give any reaction to anything he said.
And who would my boss be?
Abrenio rubbed his face with his left hand, revealing the monogram on his cuff.
Really? Do we really have to play the whole game?
Okay, fine. They want to know about Armand Cortez. How would I know anything about the leader of a drug cartel?
I never said anything about a cartel, Abrenio said.
He flashed a gotcha grin.
I read the newspapers, Connie said. It's hard not to know about the Cortez cartel. The media likes to call it the C-squared, right?
She had practiced this particular lie so many times that it felt like the truth. She'd been very, very careful over the years. She wasn't yet entirely convinced that they weren't playing a bluff hand. "The government has you, Connie," Abrenio said. "You can claim the opposite all you want, but I'm telling you that they know the truth. I don't know specifically what they know or how they know it. It's too early in the process for that, but they're clearly playing a very strong hand, at least in their own opinion."
"So you want me just to plead guilty to something I haven't done?"
"No. I want you to listen so you can save your own life. The government is offering full immunity to you in return for testimony that will put Armand Cortez behind bars." Connie recoiled in ersatz horror.
"How could I do that if I don't know the man?"
Abrenio's jaw locked. He didn't want to play anymore. Connie changed her tack.
"You say you're a lawyer. For the sake of argument, I'll take you at your word. But I've been an attorney for a very long time in the D.C. area. While I can't claim to know every lawyer in the DMV, I'm pretty much sure I've heard of all the good ones."
There was a test in there to see if he knew the current vernacular for the District, Maryland, and Virginia, formerly known as the Greater Washington Metropolitan Area.
"Judging from your suit, you make good money. I am certain I've heard of all the lawyers who make good money."
Abrenio chuckled. "You just don't want to believe, do you?"
"Would you, if you were in my position?"
"Probably not. But then again, I would never find myself in your position. I am, in fact, from out of town. Holland, Michigan, a little burg about an hour from Detroit. They brought me in because they could count on me to be clean." Connie considered floating a "clean of what?" but decided against it. Abrenio wasn't done. "It might not seem like it to you, but my being here saves your life. If your boy Rafael Iglesias were here, what do you think he'd do with the immunity deal? Tell you what, don't answer. I'll answer for you. He'd tell you to turn it down, and then he'd run back to his real client, and you'd either spend the rest of your life in jail or you'd be dead." Connie understood the stakes here. She didn't understand how the government knew what they thought they knew, but she was fully aware of the truth. By giving her immunity, they thought she would confess to anything she wanted to confess to, all by way of betraying the most terrifying, ruthless man she'd ever known. To speak would commit herself and her boys to whatever was the Mexican version of a fatwa. Armand Cortez would let none of them live if she turned on him. At least now, by keeping quiet, she could keep Ryder and Jeff safe.
"How are my children?"
she asked. "They're not my problem."
"Are they safe?"
Abrenio's expression showed total disinterest. "How could I possibly know that?"
"You're in a position to ask, and I'm not,"
Connie said, and she realized that she'd stumbled on her perfect dodge. "Until I find out about them, I won't say a thing to you. Look, Connie, this is a good deal, and I don't know how long it will be on the table, especially if you piss them off." Connie took her time answering. "Without admitting anything, if they have the kind of leverage over me that they seem to think they have, and they're squeezing me this hard for information, that means they don't have enough on the cartel to get a conviction without me. They'll wait."
"I'm not so sure," Abrenio insisted. He seemed agitated.
It took everything Connie had not to explode with anxiety as she said,
"My children, Mr. Abrenio, what you're suggesting, if it were to apply to me, to us, would put us all in unspeakable danger. If you assure me that they're safe and that any potential deal would include them, then maybe we'll have something to talk about."
She'd nearly run out of breath as she spoke. Very little time remained before she broke down. Abrenio leaned in.
"Listen to me, Connie. We are done," she said.
And she turned her back on him.